This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba's here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Now, if you have a question for Zorba, this is a great time to give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, along with our great calls, we have some interesting topics to talk over.
Yes, we're going to talk about cervical cancer screening. How often should it be done? There are many clinicians, new data shows, that are doing it too frequently. There's some guidelines, there's some rules, and they're simply not being applied by lots of doctors out in America. Mm-hmm. And nurse practitioners, by the way, too.
Yeah,
and light cigarettes, low-tar cigarettes, they're going to be taken off the market. Why are they going to be taken off the market, and what does this mean for the smokers who are around America?
And the rest of us who have to be around the smokers America. What's
exactly
our recipe?
Sorrel-wrapped beet snackers. I mean, Tom.
Did you think to yourself, what would make Tom Clark
reject? You drag. Sorrel-wrapped beet snackers.
All right, anyway, it's coming up whether I like it or not.
Doesn't that sound like something that you would really like to have, with your swim?
Exactly. We have our medical myth buster coming up, too, later in the hour. Right now, Zorba, let's get to the phones. A listener joins us in Palatka, Florida. Hi.
Hi. Glad to be with you guys. Molly and I love your show. And Tom, as part of the Who Does Tom Look Like? Because we laughed several weeks ago.
Yeah.
People said you look like Adam West.
Right.
I'm going to throw in the name Paul Stokey of Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Not bad. You think?
Yes.
Not bad.
I think it's a real close match. Dr. Zorba, my question, I have been off cigarettes for nearly 5 years. Every day I chew 8 to 10 4-milligram generic nicotine gum products. I don't do it as the directions say. You let it get that burning sensation, then you stop chewing it. I just chew it with a piece of sugarless gum, and more or less all day I'm just kind of chewing my gum. Never the desire to ever smoke again. No more smoker's cough, no more indigestion, no more of those smoking things. Skin has returned to a vibrant color, but you know, you always get people who look at you and go, wait a minute, now you're addicted to nicotine gum. And I always say to them, well, isn't that better than smoking paper and all those carcinogens? But basically, am I in any kind of danger to just continue chewing the gum?
You are not in danger. And let me tell you a little bit about it, because this is a question that comes up. By the way, about 5% of the people in a number of studies have been shown who use nicotine gum, generic is just as good as name brand, no reason to spend the money on the name brand. But about 5% of the people continue to chew the gum on and off for many, many, many years. In fact, nobody's ever done studies to see how many years people basically chew it. And the data clearly shows that people who chew the gum are not at risk. They're not at risk for lung cancer. They're not at risk for cancer of the lips or the tongue at all. It is a safe form of nicotine. And people do come up. It's very common for people to say, wait a minute, now you're addicted to the gum. But the reality is the gum is not going to kill you.
Nicotine then itself is not bad for us.
Well, that's very interesting. Nicotine, obviously, when it's smoked in a cigarette form, is bad for us. That we know for sure. But it's not only the nicotine that's bad for us. It's the nicotine. It's the carcinogens that are there. It's the paper. It's the carbon monoxide that's also there. There are a whole bunch of other things that basically produce heart attack, stroke, and lung cancer. But nicotine in an oral form, in the gum form, isn't bad. Now, nicotine in a snuff form, like the snus, which are the new snuff packets that you put in, but you know, in the gum line, cause lip cancer, tongue cancer, cancer of the oral pharynx, cancer of
Why doesn't the gum cause that, though?
Well, that's a good question, but it doesn't. That's all. It's been tested. Why doesn't? because when you look at tobacco products, there's more in a tobacco product. It's not just nicotine. Nicotine is just one aspect of a tobacco product. You've got everything else that's in tobacco that must be carcinogenic. That must be what it is. So, By the way, you chew it the way you want to chew it. I mean, you know, nobody pays attention to those directions. I mean, they may do initially, but a lot of people wrap it in juicy fruit because they don't like the taste. Basically, what they're saying is once that certain taste is gone from the gum, the nicotine is no longer present in there, and you just chew it as you need to. How much does your habit cost you?
I buy the generic for about $32, and that is just about 3 weeks, Dr. Zorba.
3 weeks. So it's $10 a week.
Oh, yeah. Big savings, right?
Huge. You look at how much cigarettes cost in America. There is no comparison.
Yeah. No comparison. My life has been clear and good and happy.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
You are doing a great job, and you are a model for other people who want to quit smoking.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Now, Zorba, this sounds interesting to me. The pre-screening for cervical cancer rules are being changed.
Well, they've actually been in the process of being changed for a number of years. And so let's go back. For a number of years, the concept was you screen every woman from cervical cancer, basically from the time she's sexually active or 18 years of age until basically well in their 70s or 80s. And then a lot of data started coming out over the period of the last 30 years. Some data showing, for instance, that cervical cancer is basically a sexually transmitted disease caused by human papillomavirus. And so that's what causes cervical cancer. And so the recommendations have changed. Recommendations have changed. Women, for instance, who are over 65 in terms of their screening, for most cases, do not have to be screened. Women who have had a hysterectomy, of course, don't have to be screened. But low-risk women don't have to be screened except once every 3 years. So, for instance, women who are at low risk after the age of 30 only have to be screened every 3 years, yet many of these women are still being screened yearly by their clinicians.
Now, what does low risk mean?
Well, generally, low risk are a bunch of things. If you have a single partner, if you don't have multiple partners, if you don't have human papillomavirus, if you've been tested for that, there are a lot of factors that go into it. If you've had one or two negative pap smears. And so there's a certain guideline. It's kind of a formula, and you plug it in, two negative pap smears. Some women get HPV testing for the virus, and lo and behold, you discover if it's every 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years. Now, the problem is right now, many clinicians in the U.S., doctors, nurse practitioners, physicians' assistants, are simply following the old guidelines of a woman who's sexually active will be screened every year. And not only is that causing an increase in the cost of medical care, but it's unnecessary. And no woman wants to go into her doctor and have a pap smear if she doesn't need to have a pap smear. So I think it's very important for women to know when they should be screened and when they shouldn't be screened,
yeah,
as well as their clinicians.
But now there's always this concern when we sort of relax the screening procedures about, wait a minute, you're saying now only once every 3 years, but maybe I shouldn't wait 3 years. Maybe I should do it every year just to be absolutely certain.
Well, there's some interesting things. First of all, cervical cancer is a slow-growing cancer. I think there are women who are still going to want to be screened yearly, and I think those women should be screened yearly.
You know, we ran through this with mammograms not that long ago.
Absolutely. But this is good scientific information. But getting back to that, if a woman says, look, I want to be screened every year for cervical cancer, I think she ought to go in and get screened every year for cervical cancer. Mm-hmm. I think if you want to be screened more often than not, you should have a right to be able to go in and do that. I think that's okay. But I think a lot of women, when they sit down and look at the data, are going to say, well, maybe I don't have to have it every year. Maybe that's old-fashioned. I only need it every 3 years. And what we'll do is we'll put it on our website, zorbapastor.org. We'll put down the recommendations right now so that women can go to that website and find out if they need to be screened every year or every 3 years.
Good deal. 1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Now, Zorba, let's welcome a caller in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
We appreciate it. How can we help?
Well, my question concerns playing summer tournament lacrosse, which requires playing 3 games a day for 2 consecutive days in a heat index of 110 degrees.
Ooh.
Number one, is it okay to do this? And number two, if you do it, what can you do to prevent heat stroke?
Can I ask your age?
You mean the age of the children playing?
Oh, it's your kids who are playing. I thought you were playing.
No, my kids.
Oh. Well, kids can do anything, can't they,
Zora? No, wait a second. Wait a second. Kids can do everything. How many adults do you see playing lacrosse?
Well, I don't see kids playing lacrosse either, so I don't
know.
It's
because they don't play lacrosse in Wisconsin like they do in other parts of the country.
I don't know about lacrosse in other parts of the country.
Well, hydration is a very important issue. So first of all, is it safe? Yes, within certain guidelines of making sure, you know, that you're hydrated and that you have, you know, that you have enough rest. And that's the question with all sports. And it's not only with all sports. It has to do also with kids who are in marching band, who wear those big, heavy, often wool uniforms, who go out and dehydrate. So let's talk about hydration. And when we look at hydration, we have to look at overhydration. There are more people who die of overhydration than dehydration in athletic events in this country. Shocking. But what happens is that's usually marathoners who overhydrate when they're running and they have hyponatremia or low sodium.
You've talked about that before,
Absolutely, so that they overhydrate. But kids on a lacrosse field or a soccer field are completely different because often they're running around and they don't really want to hydrate because they have to come off in order to actually hydrate on. And so as long as they're hydrating enough, and a way to sort of judge your hydration is how often they have to go and urinate and how concentrated their urine is. And so you can tell if your urine is more concentrated, it has a more yellow appearance, right? And if it's less concentrated, it has a less yellow appearance. So one of the things that I like to teach the teenage athletes who I counsel is look at your urine when you go to the washroom. And if it's, you know, after a game, if it's really, really concentrated and you don't have to urinate out very much, you probably were, you know, were dehydrated. And that means you didn't really hydrate yourself enough. And I think that's important to teach kids. So I think, you know, sitting down with the coach and talking to the coach about it and talking to the kids will help because, you know, if it's a hot game and it's 110 degrees humidity in the humidity index, they are not going to, they're going to sweat a lot. And they're not going to have the fluid that they need.
Now here's, I'm trying to clear myself. This is a Tom Clark may not be quite as dumb as he sounds point. caller from Jacksonville, when you mentioned lacrosse and playing, I think of lacrosse as a college sport. And I thought, oh, here's a college student calling, asking about playing lacrosse. So, are you college age?
No.
Well, it sounded to me as though you were.
Her voice sounds, thank you. You sound like you're a college age voice, and that's a compliment.
Thanks a lot.
I was going to take that as a compliment. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the call. I really appreciate it. Did I do all right with
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. You know, I think she sounded like she was somewhere between 18 and 22. Yeah. I got the same feeling. Oh, so, you know, you redeemed yourself.
Thank you. Covered my 800-462-7413.
That's right.
800-462-7413. Let's move along to Willard, Missouri now. Zorba, hi.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's up?
I'm actually calling on behalf of a question about sciatica. I'm 24. I'm kind of going through my second spiel of sciatica, and I'm really not wanting to go through another 6 months of physical therapy, and I'm wanting to know, is there any other options or ideas that you could suggest?
Uh-huh. Tell me, what kind of symptoms do you have?
It's almost like a pressure down my tailbone. But a lot of times, say, if I'm in a certain position, especially if it's sitting or laying down, it's just like a jolt of, like, I guess you could say electricity almost, like just down my right leg. And right now, in the last few weeks, it's been more in my toes. I don't want to say they're numb, but it almost feels like they're fuzzy, if that makes sense.
No, it does. It sounds like you've got some neuropathic pain, which is around L5-S1, sort of the bottom of the spine that you're getting. Let me ask you a few things. There are a couple of risk factors. Sciatica, by the way, the sciatic nerve is a great big nerve that goes down, really, the back of our spine, goes through our buttocks. You know, it's in our buttocks, and if we put pressure on the nerve, we can have pain that goes all the way down, pins and needles, you know, in the feet, and it's uncomfortable. What kind of a chair do you sit on when you're sitting on a chair, you know, when you're sitting most of the time?
If I'm at home, a lot of times I've lately been using, like, we have a hard wooden chair for our kitchen chairs. I use those just because the harder surfaces, it still is better on my back. But a lot of times I'm either in that or I'm laying on the floor just because soft, like, cushion things. That really bothers me.
Okay. One of the problems with sciatica is if you put direct pressure on the nerve, which is around the sciatic notch, which we can do when we sit on hard chairs, is we can make the sciatica worse. So one of the things that I would recommend you do is you get something called a donut. Now, they sell them at medical supply stores. They look like inner tubes, just like inner tubes that you would have at a beach. And what happens is you can then find a position of comfort where you're sitting down and not pushing on the nerve. That would be one recommendation that I would look at. The other thing is that sometimes you can get a gel cushion that you can also sit on that'll make it comfortable, so you can find, once again, a position where you're sitting on your buttock and it's not uncomfortable, but you're not putting direct pressure on the nerve. And that's important. Now, are you taking an anti-inflammatory at all?
I don't. I mean, every once in a while I'll take like a Tylenol or something just if it gets really bad. But other than that, not very often.
Yeah, I'll give you a recommendation. I think whenever you've got inflammation of a nerve or a muscle, I recommend 2 Aleve tablets in the morning and 2 Aleve tablets in the evening. That is double the dose that's on the bottle. Don't ask me why the feds give such a tiny dose. But I've never figured out the feds anyway for things like this. But double the dose and do it for about 2 weeks because that may reduce the inflammation in the nerves. So it's 2 Aleve. They're all the same, 220 milligrams, twice a day in the morning and the evening. Now, when you went to physical therapy, did they give you some exercises? Is that what they did?
Oh, yeah. And even though I'm not going to physical therapy now, I'm still doing those exercises. And
Good. And
a lot of that, it seems just to localize the pain instead of my legs to my lower, part of my back. And that's really what that is. But a lot of my pain issues in the very morning when I first get up and stuff. And so that's when I usually do all my exercises right then and there.
Super. That's what you should do. So cushioning, so you're not putting direct pressure on the sciatic nerve. Exercises are important, and anti-inflammatories for like 2 to 3 weeks. And I think basically most people can get over the realm of sciatica. And then we'll give you some other information, and we'll attach it to our website, zorbapastor.org, and I'll give you some other tips on sciatica.
Thanks, guys.
Yep, appreciate the call. Thank you. And before the break, Zorba, let's jump over to the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and take this quick question from Renee in St. Louis, Missouri. Renee may be nicknamed Lady in the Lake after this email. She writes, last weekend I fell into a small lake when trying to step from a dock into a paddle boat. This was around noon. That evening, around 7, I very suddenly began to experience itchy eyes and ears, sneezing, sinus congestion and headache, coughing, muscle and joint aches, and extreme fatigue. I'm curious as to whether the illness could have been caused by something in the lake water. It seems strange to me that it would come on so suddenly with no prior symptoms.
Well, she fell into the lake. That's kind of a prior symptom.
Yeah, but that was hours before.
Like that. Yeah, but lake water has lots of stuff in it. That's not unusual. A lot of people fall into lakes, and afterwards they either breathe in the water. The lake may have algae in it. It may have bacteria in it. I mean, lakes are not sterile environments at all. Quite the contrary. You know, they usually have lots of different things within them. So quite often that'll produce a problem. One of my best friends who I go whitewater rafting with fell off a boat. We were doing the Green River, and fell off the boat into the river and didn't feel very good right afterwards and got a pneumonia after that. So it always reminds me that lake water, especially if you breathe it in, if you get any amount in your lungs, if you're coughing at all, can produce lots of problems. So my recommendation is stay on land forever. Never go near a lake and you'll be fine.
I'm going to a lake in northern Wisconsin in just a few weeks from now.
That's right. Well, just don't fall off the pier and end up in the lake.
I go lakes in the lake. Beautiful. I swim in the lake.
Oh, how do you like it?
I love it.
Oh, it's great.
So shut up with that.
What's that for everybody? This is advice for this woman. It's not for you.
Don't swim or paddle away from your lifestyle questions. Send them to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up. Maybe you'll like it. we have some more of your calls, some interesting research, and of course our medical myth buster here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. We have a line open for you if you'd like to give us a call now at 1-800-462-7413. But Zorba, before we take our next call, it's recipe time. This one for sorrel.
That's right, sorrel.
Sorrel wrapped beet snackers.
You're so incredulous. You know, that voice defines incredulous.
I can't think of any of those words that's attractive to
wrapped.
Me.
How about wrapped? Wrapped is okay.
Sorrel, like I assume, is some kind of growing thing.
That's
I don't like anything wrapped. I don't like tacos or any of that wrapped
like
stuff.
Beets.
Beets I don't enjoy. And snackers I don't snack.
So this is
sock
not...
it to me. First of all, what are we talking about when we say sorrel?
So this is the non-Tom Clark recipe.
Yeah, you got
almost
it.
Almost like tofu.
Yeah. Well, tell us about sorrel.
Well, sorrel, first of all, one of the reasons that we're doing this is really we're highlighting certain vegetables and certain fruits that have a certain importance to us. Mm-hmm. So when we look at color in fruits and vegetables, it turns out that color is very important. The more colorful the fruit, the more likely it is to have vitamins, minerals, carotenoids, flavonoids, phytoestrogens, antioxidants, everything that Mother Nature has to offer.
Same thing with veggies?
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely. So when you look, for instance, at a colorful orange carrot, it has 14 different kinds of beta carotene. Not one kind of beta carotene, mm-hmm. 14. And of course, carrots are very colorful because they're orange. Now, you look at iceberg lettuce, it doesn't have much in it at all.
And the better lettuce, the kind that tastes better, is better for you too.
That's right, because it basically has more vitamins and minerals. So when you're looking at when I go around and I talk about longevity around the country, I talk about color coordinating your plate. And I'm not talking about using Fiesta ware so that you have colorful plates. I'm talking about putting color on your plate. If you're eating nothing but beige, you're not eating the right food. Yeah. I mean, beige is not the right color. So the real question is, how do we look at other green leafy vegetables, and how do we make them tasty, and how do we make them unique? And sorrel is a good example. Now, sorrel... it's a plant. It's a pretty tall plant. Its roots go deep into the ground. It's got juicy stems, and basically the upper stems, you know, change color. They become a little crimson as it goes on. But we're looking at common sorrel, which has been cultivated for centuries. It's been used in soups. A sorrel is commonly used as a spice. You can buy dried sorrel to use, for instance, in split pea soup. It's used in salads, and it's something that may be useful that people have never thought about.
Yeah, it's spicy, but it isn't spicy. Like hot spicy.
It's not hot spicy. And another thing that's useful is there are a number of people, especially during the summertime, that buy shares of a market. So they buy shares of a farm. And when you buy shares of a farm, you go to your local house, you pick up your farm share, and then what you do is you cook with the fruits and vegetables that are locally made, either from a farm's market or from your farm share. Mm-hmm. And sorrel is becoming more and more popular, so people need to have ways to use it. So let's look at it. Sorrel-wrapped beet snackers. So I brought you at least to the point where you'll consider the recipe.
Well, let's do it.
Okay, let's do it. Okay, three medium red beets, stemmed cuts to cut to 1 inch. So red beets, get them from your farmer's market, stems cut to 1 inch.
Three medium red beets, stems cut to 1 inch.
That's right. And if you don't get it from your local farmer's market or grocery store, it'll be okay.
Yeah.
2 tablespoonfuls of olive oil.
2 big tea olive oil.
Okay. A 4-ounce log of fresh, mild goat cheese that you're going to have chilled, and of course it's going to be in the refrigerator.
4-ounce log of fresh mild goat cheese chilled. It comes in logs.
Yeah, because it's sort of a soft cheese. Now, if you don't like goat cheese, you might try sheep cheese, which is also good. You could also use, if you don't want to use that, you could use a brie cheese, and you could even use cream cheese.
About blue cheese.
If you want to. You could use blue cheese here. You like blue cheese?
That's my favorite, yeah.
Do you like gorgonzola cheese?
Yeah,
it's like, I've got a great recipe for gorgonzola. I'll bring it in next week. I've got wonderful gorgonzola.
Let's toss this one and do that one right now.
All right. But you could use gorgonzola cheese here too. And then 15 fresh sorrel leaves halved with the ribs and stems discarded.
15 fresh sorrel leaves halved with the ribs and stems discarded.
Okay, preheat the oven to 425 degrees and let's make it. Wrap the beets in foil, roast in the center of the oven for 1.5 hours or until tender. Now, if you want to get a barbecued flavor, you could take the beets, just put them on the barbecue, and just roast them until they're gone. Mm-hmm. And they will give a barbecued taste to it that I think is even better. And that's usually from the other oily stuff that's been on the barbecue. Let it cool, then discard the stems and cube them into 1/4-inch slices. So you're slicing this. Line a tray with plastic wrap and brush with a tablespoonful of oil. Then cut the goat cheese log crosswise into 1/4-inch slices and then halve them. So you've got these little slices that are then halved. Arrange the goat cheese slices in one layer on the tray. Brush it with the remaining oil and top each cheese with a piece of beet. So you got the cheese there and a piece of beet. Then arrange the sorrel leaves with the veins side up on a separate work surface. Place the cheese and the beet stack in the middle of each leaf. Wrap the sorrel leaf over the stack and secure with a toothpick.
I've got to say, this sounds as though it's a very attractive snack.
You bring up a good point. My daughter, Vanessa, always says, "Dad, you're a great cook, but you're lousy at display." And I have to tell you, it's really an important thing. So we had a number of people over at our house. We had 20 people over at the house because we were doing a fundraiser for a Tibetan cause that I'm involved in. And she was there with me, and she said, "Dad, let me take care of the appetizers." And she had the most beautiful displays of things, fruits and vegetables and cheeses and other snacks that were there. This is beautiful because, like you said, it's a beautiful display. And not only there, you've got the crunch from the beet, you've got the goat cheese, which is good, and then, of course, you've got this leaf, which is a green leafy sorrel leaf, which has phytogens, just like we talked about, vitamins, minerals, carotenoids, and flavonoids.
Now, we're calling these snackers. They'd be appetizers, too.
Yeah, they'd be appetizers. You could call them appetizers. Yeah. Snackers is kind of a sexier term.
Yeah.
Easier to use only, easy to make, by the way, 22 calories for each snacker, low fat, high in fruits and veggies. Try it. You will love it.
Now, if I wanted this recipe, how would I get it?
You would get the recipe. I've got an amazing thing. It's called The Net. And if you go to ZorbaPastor.org, you can find this recipe, many of our other fine recipes, and you can sign up for our weekly podcast. And that's on ZorbaPastor.org.
That's on the computer, right?
Yes, Tom.
Our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. Here's a caller now, Zorba in Muscadet, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help you?
I love your show.
Thank you.
It's the best show. What I'd like to know is Dr. Zorba is always talking about eating nuts. Well, I have an allergy to tree nuts, and I can't eat tree nuts. And they're always saying, eat nuts for lowering your cholesterol and other things. What do I eat?
Well, first of all, there are other ways to lower your cholesterol.
Well,
but
yeah.
But are you allergic to all nuts?
I've never really eaten a lot of nuts because I'm not real fond of them. But I've always liked those little chocolate with the caramel in the nuts.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I ate those. And then I had somebody made brownies and put pecans in them and I couldn't figure out what happened, but my palms and my hands and my feet blistered.
Well, first of all, you may be allergic to pecans. You may not be allergic to other nuts.
Okay.
So you may not be allergic to cashews, pistachios, walnuts, almonds. There are a whole bunch of other nuts. So maybe very specific to the protein that's found in pecan. Of course, all the nuts are different. I mean, they're not all, I mean, they are all in a family, but they're all different. So if you want to try another nut, you could try another nut. Also, you know, it's possible that you were allergic to something else that was actually used in the preparation of that pecan, just to let you know. And so you may talk to your doctor. I wouldn't take other nuts until I had an EpiPen.
I have an EpiPen I carry.
And that's what I would have. So I might go to the doctor's office and say, look, I want to try some cashews. I'm going to sit in your office. And if I have a cardiac arrest, please revive me. But, but I'm serious. I'm being somewhat facetious and serious.
No, I'm serious because we were at a friend of ours was in the hospital. And we were sitting in the waiting room. And I said to my husband, can I go get some nuts and try this? Because I'm at the hospital. And he goes, no.
No, you're in the hospital for another. But seriously, you may decide to do that. You can also get some tests from an allergist. But once again, most people, if they're allergic to one nut, they're not necessarily allergic to all nuts.
Oh, I always thought you were allergic to all nuts.
No, not necessarily at all.
Oh, okay.
Now, when we talk now about lowering cholesterol, there are a lot of ways to lower cholesterol. By the way, nuts don't lower cholesterol. It's that omega-3 fatty acids that are in nuts are good for heart disease, and they may help. They may help prevent heart disease, but a diet that is a sensible diet that not being obese, not having carbohydrate loads that produce high, eating high glycemic foods, all those things, are good to help prevent heart disease. Nuts are not the only thing. A fiber, by the way, also reduces cholesterol. So getting high fiber breakfast is good. So you don't like cashew nuts?
I've never been fond of nuts.
Pistachios don't turn you on. You don't
none
like pistachios.
They all taste bitter to me.
Really?
Yeah.
So nuts.
And I've never been big on them, and I never ate them except with the chocolate and the caramel.
Yeah. Well, the chocolate. So you can still eat the chocolate and the caramel without the the pecans.
Yeah,
so.
That's usually what I do.
Yeah, that's what you do.
And it's amazing how many people cook with nuts and don't tell you.
Oh.
You know, I mean, they'll say, here, would you like a cookie?
Yeah, no, that's right. They make it. Baked goods are often have nuts.
In fact,
in fact, in the grocery store, the nuts are always in the baked aisle, aren't they? That's always where they are. So, I might talk to my doctor and make sure so you don't have to limit yourself from all the wonderful baked goods that people obviously are offering you. Clearly, people are offering you baked goods with nuts. Now, ask Tom, do you get many baked goods offered to you with nuts, Tom?
Well, I eat baked goods with nuts.
He eats baked goods. Do you like
people
them?
People don't tend to offer them to me when I'm walking down the street.
Nobody's offering him baked goods with nuts. So they offer them to me, too. So you and I get offered the baked goods with nuts, and Tom's on the outside with this conversation. So, well, thank you. Good luck. I would have an EpiPen if I tried another nut.
I carry it at all times because I'm very afraid of that. Because, like I said, people do not say, "Oh, I put nuts in this."
Yeah,
and I ask everybody.
And when in doubt, if you really want to get tested, go to your local allergist and get tested for all other things because they can do that testing. So,
well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for the call. We really do appreciate it. And Zorba, before we take the break, which will, by the way, have really, really interesting information, it's time for an installment of Traveling Tips from Zorba. Today's you travel a lot.
Yeah, traveling.
Okay, so listen up. Uh-huh. Today's transcontinental traveler is Nisa from Knoxville, Tennessee, who has a question for you about sleeping on the flight. She writes, "We will be traveling from Knoxville, Tennessee, to Seoul, South Korea, via Atlanta, going west. I've heard you recommend taking a sleeping pill, but I have also heard recommendations that one should stay awake and then take a Tylenol PM or similar upon arrival that night to sleep. My worry about the sleeping pill is feeling lousy while cooped up on a plane. Your thoughts?"
Well, first of all, over-the-counter sleeping meds are basically the same thing. They're all Benadryl, generic Benadryl, diphenhydramine, which is an antihistamine. A side effect is it makes people sleepy. But a common side effect of that is it also makes many people groggy in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So of all the sleepers I would recommend, that's probably the one I would put way down the list because it's not that effective. It doesn't work that well for some people, and it has side effects. It's sort of like, choose your poison.
Yeah.
Either you don't take anything and you feel lousy on the plane the whole time because you can't sleep, or you decide to take it. I don't think there's one way or the other. I think it's you decide what you want to do. For me, I like to sleep on the airplane because basically I like to avoid as much of the trip as I can.
Yeah.
And once I get there, I like to be kind of awake.
Yeah,
and
you don't want to ruin the first day you're someplace.
No. And if it happens to be night when I arrive, well, then I take another half of a sleeping pill so I can sleep that evening.
Mm-hmm. By the way, beware going through Atlanta coming home. It's a little known fact that about 1% of the people going through customs at the Atlanta airport are never heard from or seen again. We had an awful experience going through customs.
I can just imagine. So it's sort of the Bermuda Triangle of Atlanta.
Well, you can't pack Zorba in your suitcase, so check with him before you leave during our next edition of Traveling Tips from Zorba. Just send your question in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Stick around. We have a really interesting topic to talk over, lots more of your calls, and, of course, our medical myth buster here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. A line is open for you now. But before we take our next call, Zorba, new regulations in place now on labeling of cigarette packages.
That's right. That's right. Let's look at cigarettes and what tobacco companies have basically done to cigarettes throughout the years. First of all, they put in filtered cigarettes. Mm-hmm. You look back, you know, in the 50s.
Much better for you, those filters.
Yeah,
cigarettes.
That was the whole idea. The whole idea is filtered cigarettes would filter out the bad stuff. When I smoked back in college for 3 years, I'd look at the filter and I'd say, look at all the filters, all brown. It got rid of all that brown stuff.
Yeah.
That was bad stuff. It wasn't going into my lungs. That was the whole idea. It would filter out tar and nicotine and, yeah, and harshness, and basically got rid of the harshness, but it still caused just as much cancer. And then they introduced mild, low tar and light cigarettes.
Yeah.
And the concept being, well, I can smoke a light cigarette. It's going to be okay because it's light. There's not as much of a risk. But you know, yeah, what happens with light cigarettes is people take a deeper breath and they hold it longer.
Yeah. What about the low tar thing?
Same thing. Deeper breath, hold it longer. There is no evidence that low tar, light, or mild cigarettes are healthier for you, not as deadly, as regular Camel cigarettes. I mean, Camel or Pall Mall cigarettes, you know, which I don't even know if they make those anymore, you know, the unfiltered were just as bad. And so what has happened is the feds have now said you've got to get rid of it because the concept of light, low tar, and mild basically means that it's a healthier cigarette. And so they finally decided to get rid of it. It's a great idea.
Yeah.
Now, is it going to make a difference? Yeah, all these little things make a difference. You know, as soon as you raise the price of cigarettes, a few people stop smoking. You know, it lowers the incidence. As soon as you make it so you can't smoke in the workplace, does it make a difference? Yeah, a lot of people stop smoking. Will it get rid of the hardcore smokers? Well, the fact is, this is now truth in advertising. A cigarette is a cigarette is a cigarette, but, and that's what you should realize if you're smoking.
Maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me this is going to save the cigarette people a lot of money, though. Now they probably aren't going to be making different kinds of cigarettes. They're just going to say Camel or whatever, since they can't say low tar.
Well,
or then why would they make different?
Well, where our goal is not to get the cigarette.
Oh no, I'm not saying that
money,
we shouldn't do it.
But you bring up a good point. Maybe they'll have fewer cigarettes. That'll be better for them. But the fact is, they advertise the low tar, and this has been a big seller. The reason why these other cigarettes exist is because they sold.
Yeah.
I mean, otherwise you would start to see people smoking non-filtered cigarettes. Yeah. You don't see that anymore.
And now we can just keep saying all cigarettes are bad for you. Period.
Correct. And that's really the whole concept. And that's more truth in advertising and more to the point. So generally, it takes people 4 good tries to quit. Everyone should try to quit. It's wonderful. It's great. You'll breathe better. It's possible. Don't sell yourself short. And now light, low tar, and mild are out of there. There's no such thing as a safe cigarette.
800-462-7413, toll free, 1-800-462-7413. On we go, Zorba, to a listener in Seymour, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hey there.
How can we help you?
Well, I had a question about a home remedy. They used to sell these in the pharmacy. I'm not sure if I still see them anymore, but ear candles. And I was wondering if those things actually do clean the funky, nasty stuff out of your ears.
Remember, Zorba, years ago now, we actually had some of those ear candles here in the Wisconsin Public Radio on Your Health studio, and we have photos of either you putting an ear candle in my ear or me putting an ear. I think you were putting one in my ear.
I think I put one in your ear, and then we light it, and then we lit it all the way down to the point where you started screaming and yelling.
I don't remember that part. I think
no, it wasn't I
lived through the process.
You lived the dream.
Yeah.
You lived the dream.
That wasn't the dream, but I lived
the dream.
So, are they any good? Do they do anything?
I don't think they do much at all. I mean, I think they're an old. The idea was not that they would clean out the wax.
It was a good photo op, though, for the Zorbapastor and Health Program.
It's a good photo op. Actually, we had lots of comments on that photo op. Maybe we can get that out of the archives of the photo op, if not do another
one. Throw it on the web, maybe.
But the idea was that this will basically clean out the earwax, which it really doesn't do anything at all, that it'll ventilate the ear canal so that you'll be able to hear better, that it'll get rid of the fluid inside the ear. You know, and I think it's a folk remedy that's come up short. Mm-hmm. Now, there's some folk remedies that I think, you know, are worthwhile and worthy, but this particular one, I worry about it. Why? Because you light it, and it's heat, and it's made out of wax or some other material, and you run a risk of fire. So I pretty much have never recommended an ear candle or a candlelight to anyone. Now, have you used it at all?
No, I haven't used it. I was curious about it. Uh-huh. I can only find it in the hippie stores now. So
in the hippie.
I don't know. I'm not worried about setting myself on fire or anything. So,
why do you go into those hippie stores?
What? Oh, they smell nice.
They smell nice.
You buy any of those products in the hippie stores?
The products in the hippie stores? What? You mean the t-shirts?
I mean those like specialized pipes, for example.
Oh, tobacco use only? Well, I'm not admitting anything on the radio. I don't.
Well, have a nice day.
All right. Certainly will. Thanks for answering my question.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. Now, Zorba, if I get this right, you don't recommend these ear candles because there is some danger involved. Yet, there you were years back, sticking one of those candles in my ear and lighting it.
Yeah, it goes to show you, doesn't it? Goes to show you.
We'll leave it
next
there.
Question, Tom.
Well, instead of the next question, let's get to our medical myth buster now. Today's Mythbuster has been one of our more popular questions through the years, so let's finally put it to rest. It has to do with those useless insects, mosquitoes. Are mosquitoes really more attracted to women than men? And I'm going to guess, yes, they are.
And the answer is they're more attractive to bigger people versus smaller people.
Oh.
It has nothing to do with gender at all. It's the size of the person and how much carbon dioxide they're actually producing. So
wait
it's
a minute.
Two
do
sets
bigger
of things.
People produce more carbon dioxide?
They're just attracted to bigger people. We know that.
But do
know
they
that.
Produce
well,
more carbon
it all
dioxide?
Depends on how much carbon dioxide you produce is a function of how much you're breathing at that particular time.
Yeah, so it doesn't
and how much exercise. No, but bigger people tend to attract. Maybe it's because of their surface area.
Yeah.
Maybe it might be a possibility.
Yeah. Yeah.
People who sweat more, they're attracted to sweat. People who produce more carbon dioxide, they're attracted to more carbon dioxide that's produced, and they can just sort of light in. So they light in on the size. Maybe it's the heat from the size because heat is something they hone in on, and maybe it's definitely the carbon dioxide. So it kind of depends on the size of the person. It doesn't depend on the gender of the person. Now, there is something that attracts mosquitoes besides that, and it has to do with whether or not they're wearing perfume.
Yeah.
And women tend to wear perfume more than men. So it may be that women who wear perfume are more attractive, or maybe some people just smell better than others.
I'm thinking women tend to smell better
so
than men.
So maybe it's maybe some, except mosquito. Yeah, maybe, you know, that plays a factor, but that would be part of the myth thing. But, you know, some of these studies, you know, they're not exact studies. So, you know what? We'll just put it in larger people versus smaller people. Small people won't get bit as often as large people.
Yeah. So, but you just tossed that. Does it mean that we're still up in the air?
We're always up in the air because I was just thinking about the fact that little kids always get bit by mosquitoes.
And
they always swell up and they're small.
Yeah.
So you know what? The Archives of Internal Medicine that ran the study, it doesn't have all the answers to everything in the world. We're going to leave this myth stay as it is.
If you're itching to have Zorba bust a medical myth, just send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Now, Zorba, a listener with us in Milford, Ohio. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I'm a 59-year-old fella going on 39 in terms of my spirit, but I need to get a little advice how to go from being fairly sedentary in terms of office work and things like that, and to get back into a more vigorous lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
We do some walking, but not too much. But would like to get some advice on how to get back where I can. can do some of the things I used to do when I was younger.
Well, Zorba will certainly help you with that. But first, tell us what the different mindset is between having a 59-year-old mind and a 39-year-old mind.
Well, I still chase my wife.
Hey,
and
I think
she
lets
me catch her.
I think that's still a 59-year-old mindset, maybe even a 69 or maybe even a 79.
Yeah.
Ask some 79-year-olds or maybe even 89-year-olds these days.
There you go.
Yeah, you know, that's by the way, you bring up a really important point. Before we go into the exercise thing, I want to talk about the sex thing, because I think that's important, too. You know, in our youth culture, the concept is, well, after a certain age, you stop thinking about sex or being involved in sex or intimacy. And the fact is, that's a complete fallacy, and that's really ageism. It's an ageist concept that really comes from our advertising brethren and sistren who want to believe that, you know, that sex is only to be had in the youth. And the fact is, sex and intimacy, it's been shown time and time again, can exist throughout the life space. And so having that 39-year-old mindset is really critical, because the concept that all of a sudden you're going to, you know, you get to be a certain age and you stop thinking about or having desire, usually there's something else going on. Mm-hmm. And it's usually something physically. And so the idea of getting yourself physically fit in 59 is really critical, not only for 59, but 69 and 79 and 89. So where do you start? Well, the first place you start is with your numbers. So what's your blood pressure?
It's about 118 over 80.
That's great. On pills or not on pills?
No, not on pills.
That's good.
I don't take any. The only thing I take is a quarter of an aspirin each day.
That's by the way, a good sign. Wait, do you actually take an aspirin tablet and break it into quarters?
I don't. My wife does.
Now, wow. That's
true love.
That's true love. That's what I was going to say. I was going to say something else, too,
like
besides
clockwork.
That. They're like clockwork. Here's your quarter of an aspirin. She wants to keep you alive, baby. That's what she's looking for. But first of all, you know, at 59, roughly about 40% of the people, maybe it's 50% of people in their late 50s and early 60s have high blood pressure. So your blood pressure is awesome, which is good. Now,
sure.
Do you need a treadmill before you exercise? Not necessarily. You need to know what your blood pressure is. You certainly need to know what your cholesterol is. Good cholesterol numbers?
Yeah, the cholesterol's pretty good. It's the triglycerides, the liver stuff, it's a little high.
Well, triglycerides, by the way, are most dietary sensitive. So in other words, if your triglycerides are high, usually it means your diet could be better. Mm-hmm. I mean, so, you know, that's part of it. So knowing the cholesterol, knowing the blood pressure, with some people, I'll say if you're going to really start on an extensive program, let's say you're going to run a marathon, maybe in that circumstance, I would get a cardiogram or put you on a treadmill. But for the most part, it's been shown that people who are at low risk, normal blood pressure, no history of heart disease, no strong family history of heart disease, can certainly start walking and graduate, you know, to exercise, running, and get your heart rate up to 80% of its maximum for 20 minutes, three to four times a week. And by the way, the maximum is 220 minus your age. That's generally what your maximum heart rate is. So it's 220 minus your age. So if you're 20-year-old, your maximum heart rate's about 200, roughly. What do you do now What do you do now?
For exercise?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, not a lot, except hiking. I mean, we go to the Cincinnati Nature Center, which is near our home, and we'll go up and down the hills and things, which are pretty steep. And I do those pretty good.
Uh-huh.
But it's just more that being in business, I'm so focused all the time on keeping it together, so to speak.
But the fact is, the fact that you can go up and down the hills at the Nature Center, I've been to Cincinnati, and I've heard of the Nature Center, and I've heard the Nature Center is simply beautiful.
Yeah.
But being in the hills and going up and down the Nature Center, if you don't have angina, you're able to do it. Frankly, you can hit an exercise program. You don't need anything else. There's no evidence, strong evidence, that somebody with your low risk really is going to benefit from being on a treadmill before you start on something. I think you're doing the right stuff. Hiking, swimming, and chasing your wife. I love it.
There you go.
Thanks.
And listening to Zorba.
Oh, there you go. Thanks so much for the call.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And Zorba, before we get out of here for the week, it's time for another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Or, as this week's installment should be renamed, Agreeing with Tom Clark. Arthur from Knoxville, Tennessee, sent a note to the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox supporting my stance on red, delicious apples. Arthur writes, I was delighted to hear Tom say that his favorite apple is the red, delicious. I've tried just about every apple I can get, either at orchards or from markets, and agree that they are not a good cooking apple. But I think that good ones taste better than any other apple I've tried.
So am I supposed to comment on this? I mean, is this like you're asking me what I think about
our listener is just saying, yes, red delicious apples are in fact delicious,
Tom Clark has better taste buds than Zorba Pastor. I guess I'll have to defer to this. Kudos to you. When it comes to apples, when it comes to tasty apples, you are the expert.
I'll tell you what.
So I will bow to you and say yes, the red delicious.
Instead of bowing, I've got an idea. Yeah. Let's put our producer to work.
That's great.
And say all our listeners should
That's old school.
I know.
Tom.
I'm sorry. Let's say that all our listeners should email Adam and say whether they like red delicious apples or other apples.
So in other words, they only have two choices. There's red delicious and all the others.
No, they can give
I think
specifics.
They ought to email us their favorite apple.
Their favorite
and we'll
apple.
Do a straw poll.
Yeah.
We'll
and
see
I
which one wins.
Actually,
red delicious.
Every listener
Granny
should do
Smith,
this.
Every single
and
listener
Adam will
in
be
the United,
happy to sort through
right.
these and to give us the results.
He's shaking his head. Yes.
During
he
a
wants
future
to do this.
Program.
Yes, absolutely.
Anyway, be a worm at Zorba's apple for our next edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Just send in your rebuttal to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. And don't forget, send us the name of your favorite apple.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Adam Friedrich and Brad Kohlberg, who run this show like Kirk and Spock, are the two guys on the other side of the glass. Adam Friedrich is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.